it's hard to tell which sites are safe and which are downright sketchy. But with Cox Panoramic Wi-Fi Advanced Security, it's easy. It protects all your connected devices, helps you avoid sketchy sites, and even sends real-time alerts straight to your inbox or phone. Plus, you can always check in with the Panoramic Wi-Fi app. So the only surprises are that there are no surprises. Learn more at cox.com/pano. Restrictions apply. Copyright 2020 Cox Communications, Inc. All rights reserved.
Getting a divorce, even thinking about getting a divorce, can be overwhelming, scary, and sometimes exciting. Join divorce coach and mediator Mandy Walker for conversations about divorce. The more you know, the easier it will be to make your divorce healthier, less stressful, and to put it behind you. Here's Mandy.
Welcome to Conversations About Divorce. I'm Mandy Walker, and today we're talking about mental health privacy in divorce. There has been and continues to be an increasing push in our society to talk openly about and to accept and destigmatize mental health issues. And that's a good thing. We're being encouraged to seek help and treatment for our issues. When we do, we expect that treatment to be confidential. There's a physician-patient privilege that protects us. It encourages us to be open and honest with our healthcare provider, and that in turn lays the foundation for more effective treatment. But what if that privacy can be broken? What if the fact that we've sought treatment can be used against us? That is the reality in divorce when one party is seeking restricted parenting. You may find that the help that you sought years ago is now being used against you. So what can you do to prepare and protect yourself? Well, my guest today is New York-based family law and matrimonial attorney Lisa Zideman. Lisa is the managing partner at Miller Zideman and Whitaker, and Lisa's written about this topic in Psychology Today. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
I thought a good place for us to start would be if you could give us a brief overview of what happens in a child custody dispute that could lead to having to provide details of your mental health treatment.
So what happens in a child custody dispute is very often parents are essentially vying for custody of their child and the ability not just to have access with their child, but also to have the ability to make decisions for the child and sometimes to make the final decision or the sole decision for major matters affecting the children. And in a custody litigation, one of the issues that people put before a court is their mental and physical health, because the court really needs to determine what is in the best interest of the children and who is in the better position to make decisions for the children and what access should be allotted to each of the parents and which of the parents should perhaps be the primary custodian for the children. And all of that centers sometimes around a party's mental and or physical health, although it usually is their mental health that is called into question or dispute, as well as addiction issues such as substance abuse, alcohol issues, and other substance abuse. And so when someone is litigating custody and a court has to determine best interest, essentially the court can look at anything that is relevant.
Okay. And so they can call, so that you wouldn't voluntarily raise this, it would be your soon-to-be ex who's looking to restrict your parenting time would say, well, wait a minute, you know, she has struggled a long time with depression and really, you know, there are days when she can't even get out of bed. So, you know, she's not going to be able to get up in the morning and take the kids to school.
That's exactly right. It is usually your ex-to-be or your adversary in that particular case who is calling into question your mental capacity or someone's mental capacity. And so very often, almost as a matter of course, if there's custody litigation and we know, for example, that a spouse of our client has had mental health issues that are significant, we will ask for the mental health records. We will ask for their therapeutic records, for any hospitalization records, for the notes from a doctor or a therapist, medications prescribed by a psychiatrist, any of those types of information documents are subject to being discovered, essentially. And so if there are suspicions that there are mental health issues, we will ask for that. And we have had clients who are married to people who are either have bipolar issues or may have mood disorders, or may have anxiety issues, borderline personality disorders. And we certainly delve into that as attorneys, because that does affect a parent's ability not only to make decisions for their child, to have access with their child, to be able to utilize information from providers for the children, but also to co-parent. If a parent has, for example, a borderline personality disorder, we often find that that parent will have significant issues co-parenting.
Right.
And that does not actually lead to a situation where someone should have, for example, joint legal custody versus someone else who does not have that condition having sole or at least final decision making for the children.
Right. Wow. I have so many questions stemming from that, Lisa. So one of the questions I have is, like you said, in discovery, you can ask for all the mental health records and history and treatment notes. Does that, if you ask for that in discovery, does that become public information?
So it doesn't become public information, and I should be careful about the word discovery. So in custody matters in some states, and that would include New York, we don't have something called discovery. So we have to, and when I say we don't have it, we essentially will subpoena records, etc., for a trial in the matter. And we don't necessarily get those records ahead of time. However, when there's mental health issues, sometimes a forensic psychologist or psychiatrist is appointed to evaluate each of the parties' mental health, as well as to evaluate who might be the parent in the better position to make decisions for the children and how co-parenting would work between the parents themselves. And so whether we actually ask for the records, and sometimes we do, many times we do, and then we will get a subpoena so ordered by a court with HIPAA forms, but also a forensic psychologist who is conducting the evaluation may also ask for those records as part of the evaluation process.
And
so,
do I have a right to say, no, I don't want my records released?
So you have the right to say no, but your no may not be the final answer, because the judge in that matter is going to make a determination of whether these records are relevant, whether they should be turned over, whether it is something that the court should look at, whether it is something that the attorneys for the parties should look at, whether it should be looked at by a forensic psychologist, and how they will be essentially distributed, who will get to see them. And you asked me specifically about whether they would be seen by the public. So they won't necessarily be seen by the public, because these records are part of a divorce action, and those are essentially closed records, but certainly they can be seen sometimes by your ex-spouse-to-be and their attorneys, and they can be entered into evidence in a court at trial.
Right.
And they can be utilized in various ways during the litigation, including in motion practice, et cetera, depending upon the restrictions that the court puts on those records.
Right. So potentially they could become public knowledge.
The answer is potentially yes. Potentially they could be, but usually the court will set restrictions on how they are to be distributed. So for example, right, the court may say the records can only be viewed in a lawyer's office and copies are not to be made. Or the court may say that the records must be kept in the courthouse and they will only be able to be viewed by the attorneys in the courthouse.
Okay.
Or the or they will be kept confidential, but they will be entered in at trial, and so there may be testimony about those records. So eventually, it is highly likely that your spouse certainly will be privy to the records, as well as their attorney, if there is a trial of the matter, because those records will come into evidence.
Okay. So if I was your client and I had a mental health history and it's my soon-to-be ex who's looking to use that in court, what would be your advice to me?
Well, my advice would be to be honest about your mental health condition, because the court appreciates honesty. The court also appreciates people who are working to work on their mental health conditions and working with therapists. And so to be honest with the therapist, to be honest with the court, to be forthcoming about the records. We have certainly seen in our practice, and we represent people who have mental health issues, those people do get custody of their children. It is not an impossibility for them to get custody, or for them to get joint legal custody, or for them to get 50% access, but they need to be consistent with their therapy. They need to be consistent with the medications that are being prescribed, to follow the directions of the provider. So I would say the most important thing that we tell our clients is that they need to actually follow the directions of the therapist. It's the clients who won't follow the directions, who essentially veer off course, who don't go to the therapist, who don't treat their addiction issues, for example, who try to hide out, who try to hide those issues. Those clients are going to have the most difficulty in court in terms of custody.
Right, because as I was doing this, I was thinking, this isn't really about the mental health issue per se, but it's more about assessing what is the risk to the children when they are in the care of that person.
That's exactly right.
So
that is exactly right.
Right, so it's about, like, you know, if there is a risk to the children's safety, then what are the boundaries or the parameters that can be put around there to protect the child?
So there are several different boundaries and protections that can be put into place. So, for example, we have constructed agreements whereby if someone is seeing a psychiatrist and there is a concern that someone will not be taking medications or will not be adhering to the advice of the provider, there can be blood testing, for example, to make sure people are taking the amount of medication they should be taking. And we have actually put that into agreements. We have also made sure that people, both spouses, are able to contact the treating psychiatrist or psychologist if they think that there is an issue, and that treating psychiatrist or psychologist also is allowed to, pursuant to the agreement, reach out to the other parent if there is a concern that someone is no longer following the advice or taking the medication that has been prescribed by the provider. And so those types of safety guards are put into place in an agreement. And if you're going to construct an agreement and you think that your spouse has a mental health issue, these are some of the things that you can put into place. There are also other things that we do, such as supervised access, where the parent who may have the mental health condition and may not be being treated by someone, or may not be cooperative in treatment, or the particular disorder may not be as treatable as other disorders, then
right,
supervised access may be more appropriate for that particular parent with the child, until at least the child is able to get to an age where there's no safety concerns.
Right. So I think it's just, I just wanted to make sure our listeners understood it wasn't this is not a black and white issue, and it's not an either or, it's not parenting or no parenting. It's about if there is a risk to the child, thinking through the parameters that can make parenting time safe for the child.
That's correct. This is not about no parenting. Usually. I mean, there are cases, and we have seen them, where people just will not recognize that they have a particular disorder or a particular addiction, and there are such safety concerns that even with supervisors present, it just can't work.
Right.
And so that time may be extremely limited and sometimes suspended until that person is actually being treated or has gone into a treatment program or has been hospitalized and is able to conduct himself or herself appropriately. But usually the concept is that the person is in treatment, is following the parameters by the provider and is trying to get help. And access is a question of how much access, under what conditions is the access, and how will co-parenting actually take place.
Right. Well, I've got lots more questions for you, but Lisa, we're going to take a short break here.
I think what flavor of these new Dunkin' Coconut Refreshers you get says a lot about you.
Really? What's it say about me?
Well, you got the refreshing golden peach because you're vibrant, fun, and positive.
Oh, what about me?
The bold purple pomegranate means you're vibrant, fun, and positive.
I take it I got this delicious pink strawberry because I'm vibrant, fun, and positive.
Yeah, it's a simple system, really.
Share the shine. Enjoy a medium Dunkin' Coconut Refresher for $3. Order ahead plus earn rewards. America runs on Dunkin'. Participation may vary. Limited time offer excludes classic Dunkin' Refreshers.
You're listening to Conversations About Divorce. I'm Mandy Walker, and today we're talking about mental health privacy in divorce. My guest today is New York-based family law and matrimonial attorney Lisa Zideman. Lisa is the managing partner with Miller, Zideman & Whitaker, and Lisa's written about this topic in Psychology Today. So Lisa, the question that I had asked you before was, if I was your client and I had the mental health issues, let's turn the tables around a little bit and let's say, you know, I can see situations here where somebody's going to try to use their spouse's mental health condition to use it against them and to really try and maybe unfairly restrict parenting time. And so if I was coming to you and wanting to restrict my soon-to-be ex's access to our children, how do you detect when I'm motivated by wanting revenge and control rather than a genuine concern for the child's well-being?
So, first of all, we speak to our clients and we watch what our clients are, how our clients interact with the other parent in terms of reading emails, reading text messages. And I personally feel like I know what a client's motives are, probably after the first consultation that I have with
a
client.
Right.
You know, some of it is just experience. Right. And we have that kind of experience. That being said, we're very cautious in terms of making sure that our clients understand that utilizing mental health against the other parent is not going to necessarily help, you know, the person who's trying to essentially use that against the other parent. The reason being is that the courts are feel very strongly about the fact that a parent who is going to be the custodial parent or the primary parent should be able to foster a relationship with the other parent. And if the motivation in essentially raising this issue of mental health is not a concern but for the children, but instead a vindictive motivation, the court will usually detect that. And certainly during a forensic evaluation with a psychologist or a psychiatrist, that will likely come up as well. And so we caution our clients to make sure at all times, no matter what the situation is, that they are fostering a relationship with the other parent, because they need to remember that their children are products of both parents.
Right.
And when they criticize or when they are vindictive to the other parent, they are also in a sense being vindictive to the children, because those children are made up of both parents.
Right.
And so it's very important that people realize that no matter what the mental health situations are or the physical limitations, that these are still the parents of these children. And what, to the extent that it is safe and to the extent that it can be done, the situation should be, you know, a relationship should be fostered by each of the parents for the other parent.
Right. And I know, like, in Colorado, we have the best interest of the child statute. And part of that, one of those factors there is the ability of the parents to foster the relationship with the other parent, with the child. So I absolutely hear you on that.
That is 100% correct. And the appellate division in New York has ruled many, many times that that is one of the most important, essentially, parts of the relationship between the children and the parents that the court will look at. And so it's very important that occur, and that parents do their very best to do that, to foster the relationship, because no matter what, these are their parents.
Right. So when you're in this situation and you're advising clients, and I don't think this question matters whether it's your client who has the mental health issue or your client's soon-to-be ex that has it, but how desirable is it to try and negotiate the terms and the parameters of the parenting plan between you and the other party, as opposed to letting a judge decide? Because I was thinking, like, judges, they don't know the family, they might not have a really good understanding of what the mental health issues are, and it always seems like there's a risk when you leave it up to the judge to decide.
So I agree with that. I think that parents who can come up with their own parenting plan with their lawyers and who can essentially document and put together an agreement that works for their individual family and their individual children, they are far better off than leaving it to a court. Because, as you say, the court doesn't know these people. The court has never really seen these people before they walked into their courtroom. And it is very difficult for a court to put together a delineated plan that is specific to each individual family. And so the ability to, for example, as I said to you earlier, I've had agreements which we've drafted where one parent actually signs HIPAA forms for the other parent, and psychiatrists notify the other parent if there's issues and blood tests are taken. Well, that's very complex for a court to put together that level of detail to protect the children. So if you can do it through your attorneys and put together such a detailed agreement, that you're going to be far better off and far better able to protect your children. That being said, sometimes it's just impossible to do that.
Yeah.
And then you need to be in court. It's not always possible to negotiate every agreement, and we try very hard to do that, but sometimes you need a judge to structure the case and to make a determination, because the parents cannot come together and do that, particularly when there's mental health issues.
Right, and I would think in that situation, it's really helpful for the judge to have a proposal from the parties for a very detailed, delineated plan for how you would cope with this issue. Because that then is giving the judge a foundation to work from.
That's correct. In fact, in New York, and I don't know if you have that in Colorado, but in New York, we put together what's called a statement of proposed disposition, which is a document that we give to the court prior to a trial, which sets forth essentially what we would be asking for the judge to order after the trial. And that is essentially the roadmap of what we're asking for. And we can put in all of this level of detail into the statement of proposed disposition. But again, to some degree, the court has to have the authority to be able to do some of the things that we're asking the court to do. And it is a very difficult area for courts to get into such a level of detail when frankly, there are so many people going through the court system.
Right. Well, so that kind of points to my next question here, Lisa, and just hearing you talk about this and your knowledge about this topic, that would tell me that it's really important for somebody who's in this, for a parent who's in this situation, to get good legal representation, and that this is not a situation where you could be doing this pro se or without representation.
I would say that that's correct. Look, it is my view that in matrimonial and family law, that representing yourself unless you absolutely have to, is probably not a good idea because emotions run very high. And having someone who can advocate on your behalf in a much more calm and thoughtful manner is probably the best thing to do under all circumstances. However, when there are mental health issues, I think it becomes even more important that you have good counsel.
Well, and the other thing you get there is not only the knowledge of the legal system, but somebody coming to legal counsel like yourself, you get somebody who has been through this and dealt with this situation before so that they can come up with a structured proposal for how the parenting time would work. And I would think that that's a key thing when you're looking for legal representation is to ask the person, have you dealt with a situation involving XYZ?
That is absolutely true. It is very important that you retain experienced counsel who has dealt with mental health issues or addiction issues. I'm surprised sometimes that there are attorneys out there who haven't dealt with, for example, addiction issues, and we've suggested certain techniques or certain ways to deal with addiction issues. For example, like there is, and I don't know if you have this in Colorado, but there are things like SoberLink where you can do testing and someone can blow into a tube that's connected to a computer and you can make sure that somebody is sober. And there are times that we raise some of these issues and counsel doesn't know necessarily what this is. So it's very important that you have counsel who has experience in all these different matters so that there can be creative thinking happening and creative solutions to very difficult problems.
Right. And so that gets back to, I think, our point that we were talking about earlier, is that if you are the person who's struggling with this, is not to be driven by your fear of losing contact with your child or losing your parenting time, but to start with, you need to start gathering information about what are the solutions that are available out there.
That's correct. And I think that you need to speak to your therapist, you need to speak to the psychiatrist, you need to make sure that you consult with several attorneys and come up with an attorney who you really think has your back, and you need to research what the alternatives are.
And do you have any, this is always a hard question to ask, Lisa, but I hear it from so many people that they don't have money to pay for an attorney.
And that's a problem. I mean, particularly in New York, it is definitely a problem. There are services that people can go to, legal aid, for example, but it is very difficult in New York if you don't have the money to litigate or to negotiate your situation. And that is not easily solved. Sometimes the non-moneyed spouse will be able to ask for legal fees from the moneyed spouse, and there is a presumption in New York that the moneyed spouse should be paying legal fees for the non-moneyed spouse, and so attorneys will make applications to the court for that. But if there's absolutely no money at either side, then people have to look for a source, and many times that is where family members or friends come into play. We have many clients, unfortunately, who have to reach out to family members to help them.
Right. That's a very difficult situation, or I think that makes a difficult situation even harder. Are there some mental health issues that are more concerning or challenging than others? I mean, you mentioned it earlier when you talked about addiction issues, but also I think you said like bipolar and personality disorders.
So in my experience, the most difficult personality disorder has been borderline personality disorders, because from my experience, medication does not seem to treat, and I've been told by therapists and psychiatrists and had forensic psychologists testify about this particular issue, that is not something that is necessarily treated by medication. So whereas in a situation in terms of bipolar issues, you may be able to treat with medication, it's much more difficult with a borderline personality disorder. The other thing that I've noticed in my practice is that sometimes people will marry somebody with a borderline personality disorder and not recognize it, because one of the, the symptoms of a borderline personality disorder is that the person is 100% for you when they are for you. And when you decide that you're getting divorced, you may find that that person has really turned on you. And you may discover something that you really didn't see before, because there's only this black and white and no gray necessarily. And so we have seen that happen, where people were madly in love and then it was ending. And then when it ended, it really ended in such a tumultuous way, and unfortunately became just a horrendous, horrendous situation because of these personality disorders.
Right. And there's that, it is a quote or a meme I've seen on Facebook that says, you don't know your spouse until you divorce them. So even under the best of circumstances, but with mental health, like as you say, with the borderline, that's going to be so, so true.
Yes, I think that that's the hardest. I mean, people will tell me that, you know, they're divorcing a narcissist and narcissists will never give up. And, you know, bipolar, of course, has some mania components to it also. So there are quite a few issues, but the fact is that I think that's the toughest. That's the one that I've seen to be the toughest.
Right. Well, Lisa, we are right up on time here. I'm wondering if you've got one other piece of advice for somebody who's in this situation that we may not have covered.
I think the most important advice, and we may have covered it, but I think the most important thing is to not to delay treatment, not to decide you're not going to get your treatment because of fear that someone may find out or it may affect your custody. I think the most important thing is actually to recognize that there's an issue and then to deal with that particular issue. Mm-hmm. And that is whether it's a mental illness, an addiction, whatever it is, recognize it, deal with it, own it, and the court will usually work with you, as will your spouse at the end of the day, because they won't really have a choice if you are recognizing it and treating it.
Right. Well, Lisa, thank you so much for that. That sounds like a really good, solid advice, and I can tell it comes from years of experience.
Thank you so much.
Listeners, we've been talking about mental health, privacy, and divorce today, and my guest is Lisa Zideman. Lisa is a family law and matrimonial attorney. She's the managing partner at Miller, Zideman, and Whitaker, and she's written about this topic extensively and has been featured in Psychology Today. I think this is a difficult topic. I guess what I want to say about this is to stay focused on what is in the best interests of your child. Whether you're the person with the mental health issue or it's your soon-to-be ex, your child still has an important attachment to them and to you. And this is about how to provide parenting time while keeping your child safe. That means being realistic about the specific mental health issue, getting educated about the issue, and learning about the precautions and the protocols that can be used to structure parenting time so parent and child can stay actively engaged. And staying actively engaged is usually in the best interest of the child and will help them grow up healthy and well-adapted despite the divorce. If you can negotiate an agreement outside of court, I think it's always the best option. Thank you for listening today. If you hop over to my blog, sincemydivorce.com, you'll find a synopsis of the show there, and you can follow me at Since My Divorce on Twitter and on Facebook. And I hope you'll join us again next time for more conversations about divorce.
Cox Panoramic Wi-Fi Advanced Security protects your connected devices, helps you avoid sketchy sites, and sends real-time alerts so you're in the know. Learn more at cox.com/pano. Restrictions apply. Copyright 2020 Cox Communications, Inc. All rights reserved.
Dunkin' has what you need to conquer the day. So if you want to go from, I don't got this, to, I got this, well, then get this. A bold, smooth espresso drink from Dunkin'. Like a layered, velvety caramel macchiato, a rich, chocolatey mocha latte, or a creamy, non-dairy oat milk latte. Because this day isn't going to conquer itself. No, you're going to do that. Take a sip of You Got This with Dunkin' Espresso drinks. Order ahead on the app plus earn rewards. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary.